Unfiltered, the official Sunderland AFC podcast.
You're listening to SAFC Unfiltered, a very special SAFC Unfiltered sponsored by Alpha Security, as we're joined by Gary Bennett, MBE. How are you doing, Gary?
I'm good, thank you.
Yes, myself and Danny normally interview current players, but we thought in light of your achievements this week in particular, we thought we'd catch up with you, Gary. It's funny because you're quite a constant in our lives with your presence for in the media and obviously as a former player of Sunderland. But I think you have to sometimes just take a step back and recognise your achievements. And I guess that's what you've been recognised for this week. How was that down at Windsor Castle?
Well, it was overwhelming, really. Again, a little bit of a shock, really, when I first received my letter. It was on my birthday, near enough a year ago now. When you get something through the post, especially when it's on your birthday as well, you think it's one of the lads or somebody.
A wind up
having a laugh, really. So when I did actually open it up and read it, the first thing I did was ring my grandchildren and my sons as well to come round and make sure that I'm reading what it is saying in the letter. And, usually New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, when you wake up in the morning, you see it all coming on with the ticker tape, who's actually been receiving awards. And it's something which you're thinking, fantastic,
yeah.
But when it's actually you yourself receiving an award and you're thinking, wow, you're pinching yourself. And, I'm just trying to be a normal person. And I think that Danny as well has been through the same sort of process, especially where, when you've come through, you just wanted to play football. You'd want to try to play at the highest level you can do. And I think, I've been lucky. And I always say that. And you do need a little bit of luck in football, to get to where you want to go. You want to play at the highest level. You want to play, in front of big crowds. And, I've been lucky to do that. If you would have said, obviously playing for Sunderland Football Club, that was not on my remit.
Yeah.
From day one. But it's something which, once you start playing for the football club, it's something which it gets under your skin.
Yeah.
It's in your blood and you sort of grow into it, and it becomes part of your life.
Let's talk about your career then. Grew up in Manchester and you ended up making your first appearance for Cardiff. And when you got your MBE, I tweeted out the congratulations. And a few of my friends and people I've worked with are Cardiff fans. And I didn't realise you had such an affinity with the Cardiff fans as well, because they instantly recognised you and said, oh, Gary's a bluebird and all this kind of thing in the tweets. Tell us about your time down there, because I understand you're with your brother down there as well, weren't you?
Yeah. Again, I was lucky because I ended up, obviously, as a young lad, going to Manchester City, following my brother's footsteps, playing for your local team. Unfortunately, I never got, an appearance in the first team. But sometimes you have to come down the level to go back up again.
Yeah.
And I was given that opportunity to go to Cardiff through ex-manager of mine, Tony Book, who was the manager at Manchester City alongside Malcolm Allison. Especially when you get released as a young lad, you think, the whole world is crashed.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, where do I go from here? But sometimes you look back on that and sometimes it's been a good learning process for myself, because then you're determined, you want a little bit more, you try a little bit harder. And sometimes you go to somewhere like Cardiff, which is a fantastic club, lovely club, Cardiff. And you go there and you just think, if you can make a name for yourself, you can bounce back.
Yeah.
And I've got to say that, from day one when I went to Cardiff City, it was a fantastic, fantastic place to learn. Fantastic supporters. Met some lovely, lovely people there. And, obviously the icing on the cake was obviously my brother came a few weeks later on to join us. And it was just getting that breakthrough, getting in there. And then all of a sudden, it was me and my brother playing for the first team. We built a fantastic relationship with the supporters. We had a good time there as well, with a little bit of success, which enabled me to obviously get that move to Sunderland.
Were you always a defender as well growing up, or did you end up being there just because of your stature?
No, I wanted to play midfield, and you want to play as a striker as a young boy coming through.
Is that the same for you?
No one wants to be a defender.
Nobody wanted to defend. Yeah.
You can see the game in front of yourself.
That's right. You wanted all the glory. Yeah. But when I went to Manchester City, they seen something in me, and they said, well, look, you got a bit of pace. We'll try you at centre-back. And you could play a little bit from a centre-half position. So I started playing there, and it just built up from there. Then I went to Cardiff, and I just made that position my own.
Yeah, you followed Len Ashurst to Sunderland. He brought you. He's a very important person to you, I'd imagine. In fact, he's only one of four of the people who's made more appearances for Sunderland is Len. He passed away, only recently, hasn't he? How important was Len Ashurst for
huge,
you?
Huge, huge. People keep talking about, obviously, the awards which have won. You talk about my life. But I think, when you look back, it would never have been what it is if it weren't without for Len Ashurst. Mm-hmm. And you do need managers, coaches, people to have that belief and confidence in you to go and push on. And, Len Ashurst had that in myself. He was my manager at Cardiff City. And I've got to say that he took a big decision, a big gamble, or whatever you want to look at, to come back for me at Cardiff to bring me to Sunderland. Now, you've got to look back at the time when he did sign me for Sunderland back in 1984 to actually make that signing as a black player as well. There's only one black player before me who actually played a few games, was a lad called Rory Gregoire.
Yeah.
So for myself, which I didn't really know what I was coming into, to be fair, I'll hold my hands up about that. But for Len, he knew what it was all about. Especially for the Sunderland supporters, for the city of Sunderland as well, to bring a black player to the North East was a huge gamble, but it's something which he explained when he signed me. He said, look, there's two ways which this could go. He said, if you do well, you'll be a hero. They'll love you. But if you do badly, you'll know about it and you'll be on the first train back to Manchester. Yeah. So, yeah, it was, a lot of that is down to Len. He had the belief, and that's what you need. You need people and coaches and managers to have that belief that you can go out there and show what you've got.
What state was the club in when you first arrived? And what was your first opinions when you walked out of Roker Park at probably freezing as well, was it? And, the club were where they were at the time as well. What was your view of the club just as you were joining?
Well, to be honest, I didn't know much about Sunderland. Mm-hmm. Honestly speaking, not just about the footballing side, but even how to get to Sunderland. as I said, it was in the northeast. It was maybe the furthest I've travelled.
Did you drive back then?
Well, I went to a tribunal. My fee was set at a tribunal at Sheffield United.
Yeah.
And it was Frank Burrows who was down there at the time. And another lad who was the financial director at the time was a lad called Barry Beatty. So, we went in. It was on the same day as another player called Andy Dibble. Mm-hmm. Both of us at Cardiff. Andy went to Luton on that day and I came to, obviously, Sunderland.
Is that the keeper?
Yeah, that was the keeper. And you come out of the tribunal, they set a fee, and it was 65 grand with another 20 grand to pay after 20 appearances. I thought, well, fantastic, we'll have that because there's no way he's going to make 20 appearances.
443 appearances later.
Yeah. So, yeah, they thought, great. And you come out and you're thinking, great, I'll go straight back to Manchester now. They said, no, you're jumping in the car. I said, jumping in the car, where are we going? He said, you're going straight up to Sunderland.
That fast?
Yeah. So I thought, well, I've got no clothes.
Yeah.
And Frank Burrows obviously came in. He said, don't worry, Gary, you can borrow some of mine.
And were they dodgy clothes? Or what?
He's got some dodgy clothes. So, you're off on the way to North East. And I was thinking to myself, it's taking me hours to get here. And, as he was driving back up there as well, you get Barry Beatty, obviously the financial director, is telling me, we get a busload from Sherburn, we get a busload from Durham, we're going up Houghton Court past the boarding. He's explaining this. And so, yeah, it's the experience itself, coming to Sunderland. And then after that, it was a case of, Len Ashurst sitting me down and explaining to me what it's all about. So, yeah, it was a big learning process for myself.
Danny, was it similar for you when you joined Sunderland? Were you kind of a bit of like, oh, was that on the course somewhere in the northeast, or were you aware of where we are?
Well, we played for Chester not long, just before I'd signed in the League Cup up here. So I got an experience of it. Obviously, I think probably 12, 15,000 in the stadium that night. But obviously, coming up here, stadium alight, what, 49,000 capacity. And Sunderland at that time were fourth, fifth in the Championship. And then 2-3 weeks later, yeah, that's similar to Ben. I played for Chester on the Saturday and got a call from the agent Saturday night driving home. He said, get your bags packed. You're up the A1 tomorrow. A deal's been agreed. So that was that. Yeah, it's how it works, isn't it, really? And that was that.
Straight I don't think here, people realise that, how fast it happens. And you've got to just grab a bag or, you know, travel without it. Yeah. Like,
it's different as well, because the transfer windows, even when I came up 2004, that was October. So middle of the season, you're playing for one team on a Saturday. And a deal's been agreed over the course of the weekend. And yeah, you find yourself in a different kit the following weekend.
Yeah, and you're surrounded by different sort of players as well. So, you know, for myself as well, you know, when I'm, you can imagine back in 1984, I've signed, and especially when a previous manager signed you, all of a sudden they're thinking, oh, he's the manager's pet.
Did you know any of the players from playing against them or anything like that?
No. So straight away, you're under a little bit of pressure. You're going in there. They think he's the... Obviously, the ears.
Were they in the same league at the same time as well, Cardiff and Sunderland?
Sunderland was top level. There was in the old first division then. So you're coming into the changing rooms, and as people are and players are, they're thinking, what's he like? And can he play and whatever? And obviously, he's the manager, and Len Asher is his new signing and things like that. So, yeah, you know, you're going in and you're thinking training sessions, you're just thinking, hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, everything goes well. You can stand out. They can see what they're going to buy into. And then you're looking at, obviously, the start of the season. You're thinking, okay, if you're going to be in a squad, if you're going to be starting, what you actually got running out to. So you've got all them pressures going on you. So, yeah, but again, for the players itself, it's an experience as well. You know, it's something new because they don't know what they're buying into. You don't know what you're buying into. And again, at that time, there's, a changing room full of characters. Yeah. I think, you know, especially back in them days, different to what they are now. You know, back in, obviously, when I'm talking about 84, everybody's up to something. There's, you know, every single day there was something going on, and you know, you could get away with it then.
No mobile phones.
No mobile phones then or whatever. And
social media.
You know, there was lots and lots of things going on, and you had to do, and you know, from apprentices, is had a little bit more, shall we say, respect for senior players. You know, we talk about, you know, the old apprentices where you had to clean boots, you know, so you had somebody who looked after your boots. You looked after maybe two or three professionals at the time. You looked after them at Christmas, you know, they're what you can call the runners for you. So if anything you wanted, they got.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, I could turn around and say, right, I'm hungry. I want a sandwich. And you'd be calling one of the young apprentices, right, I need a sandwich. And they'll do the runner for you, and they'll go and get one.
Get rid of me studs.
That's right, they'll change your studs. They did anything for you, you know, because that's who, you know, David's there. Because obviously when it comes to this time of the year, Christmas, that's when they're thinking, wow, this is Christmas time.
Tips and all that.
Tips and everything like that.
But nothing like that happens in football now.
I don't think it does. I'm not sure.
They do the boots anymore.
They don't
do
the boots anymore. And, you know, what I found was that, especially when you looked after apprentices, you know, it was a different ball game. The apprentices was full. You know, they could do things. They, you know, they was here from 9 o'clock in the morning till maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon doing their jobs and whatever. And I think to myself, I think it was a good learning curve for them. For apprentices, understanding what it was like, you know, not just walking straight into a first team dressing room and thinking, right, that's it, I've cracked it. You had to earn the right to do that.
Yeah. Did you make any pals early on in your Sunderland career? Who was your friends in the dressing room?
To be fair, Sean Elliott, fantastic lad. Gordon Chisholm.
Yep.
And to be fair, majority of the team were great, because I signed on the same day. Roger Wilde signed, mm-hmm. Clive Walker signed, Howard Gale came in, another Steve Berry came in. So we had five new signings. So we sort of was sort of stuck together, mm-hmm. being new.
Yeah. A few seasons with Marco as well.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Gosh.
You can't get rid of him. Still working with him now, gosh, in 2022.
Don't mention Marco. We'll be here all day about Marco Gabbadini.
But you also had a lot of managers in your time. I think I counted 11. Going backwards, Peter Reid, Mick Buxton, Terry Butcher, Malcolm Crosby, Dennis Smith, Bob Stoker was caretaker for a while, and of course, Laurie McMenemy and Len Ashurst, mm-hmm. of course. Massively different characters there.
Yes, indeed. And, and different in changing rooms. You know, managers now are totally different to what they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, again, managers 20, 30 years ago spoke the mind. And if they didn't speak the mind, there was the other side of it as well. You know, they were very more, shall we say, passionate in regards of that. But now, I don't think it happens now. But I don't know. It was a good learning curve for me again.
Out of those ones that I mentioned, apart from Len, who was obviously important to you, I guess Dennis Smith would probably stand out because of the success with Dennis. And
well, like myself, I usually people say, who's the best manager? Who's the best manager? And I always just say, the manager who keeps picking me week in, week out.
That's the main thing.
You know, it's about playing week in, week out. And, you know, if the manager was picking you, you'd been selected, tell you what, fantastic. But when you're not selected, it's the other side of it, which you don't like. You start finding things about the manager, you know, saying things about the manager and whatever. I was a little bit lucky, but, you know, you just mentioned Bob Stoker. I played under him for a few years. Laurie McMenemy was great for me, but not for the club.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you take a little bit from every manager and you learn. Mm-hmm. You learn things, you know, you'll have managers who take a dislike to you straight away.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something which you've got to cope with. And I know we talk a lot about the mental health issue at the present moment, what's going on. And I think if you go back, and again, Daniel backed me up on this as well, we all went through them mental health issues, mm-hmm. believe it or not, because we try to tell young players nowadays that it's challenging. Mm-hmm. You're going to be, it's not what you see. You know, you only can pick, select 11 players to play on a Saturday, and then maybe have one, three or five subs or seven subs now, and you're going to be in the squad. But when you're not in the squad, that's when it affects you, because all of a sudden you're thinking, you're getting questioned. Am I on my way out? Am I good enough?
The manager doesn't fancy me.
The manager doesn't fancy me.
You train all week and then at the weekend you're not getting up and that.
Correct. So, and then you've got to come in on when the first team are off and things like that. So there's all different things which are going on, and then obviously you've got the pressure of home as well, the home life as well. You know, your wife will be asking you questions, saying, how come you're not playing this week? And you're saying, oh, Joe Bloggs is here. You're better than Joe Bloggs. You know, that's how they are. You know, that's natural. Yeah, that's a natural feeling. So, yeah, and you know, you just hope that, you know, you're in the starting 11, and then you're good enough to stay in that starting 11. So yeah, it's challenging on a daily basis.
Ben, I was going to just take it back there as well. Obviously, your time at Cardiff and Ninian Park. I played at Ninian Park a few times and never went to Roker Park. Obviously, it was demolished before my time. Similar grounds in a way. Both had that bow in the pitch, did they? Capacity wise, what would you? Similar grounds.
Yeah, the similar grounds, but Roker Park was somewhat special.
Yeah.
And the reason being, especially in night games. You know, you'll hear a lot of people talk about the Roker Roar, and that on a night game, that was...
Felt like there was more than 20.
Yeah. That was totally, totally different. You know, okay, we've had a lot of games here at the stadium, like, but to play at a Roker Park in the night game, under the Roker Roar before the ball's being kicked, is a different experience. It's a fantastic, fantastic pitch, fantastic stadium.
What about some of your highs then playing for Sunderland? What was some of the, you know, the things you look back on in your career at Sunderland and think, you know, that was a real moment? And we can talk about your lows as well, because I bet with some of those highs came the big lows as well.
Yeah, definitely so. And again, when you look back and thinking that you played that many games at Sunderland, you're thinking, wow. You didn't realise yourself, because you just enjoyed playing.
Yeah.
You know, I keep talking, and, you know, I go around all the country and talk about how special this place is, the football club is, and you've got to experience itself to understand what it's all about.
Yeah.
You know, and I was lucky enough that my debut, I scored.
You did.
You know, so that was a fantastic start for myself. And then, you know, again, as you just want to play at the highest level. As a young player coming through the system, you want to play at the highest level. You want to play in front of big crowds. You want to play at your Old Traffords and your Anfields and places like that. That's what you want to do. You want to be playing first team football week in, week out. You know, and then you go on from there. You just want to make a name for yourself. And then you're thinking, well, I'd love to play in the final. You know, that's what you want to do. You know, that's what we dream of. That's what we, you know, you grow up as a young person watching FA Cup finals on a Saturday afternoon, glued in front of the TV, and, you know, watching the build up to it. You know, I was lucky enough to play in a League Cup final back, you know, my first year in 1985. And then I played in the FA Cup final, you know, and then you're thinking you're playing a playoff final. So, you know, then you go and captain your team. You know, you're captain, you're thinking, wow. You know, and it just gets better and better as you go along. So, yeah, I've had lots and lots of highs. I've had lots of lows. But I think sometimes when you play for a club like Sunderland, you're always going to be under pressure.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time coming and want to play for a club on the, you know, tremendous support and not be under pressure. That's the expectations.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, when the good times are happening, it's fantastic. You know what I mean? But when the bad times are happening, that's something which you've got to deal with. And again, you know, we speak to a lot of players. Danny does the same as well about the supporters, about the area, about the city of Sunderland, that the Northeast, that one thing which you cannot get away from is football.
Yeah.
No matter where you go, you wake up on the Monday morning, the first thing people are saying, did we win, did we lose?
Yeah.
No matter where you go to work, shop, whatever you want to do, people talk football first. That's what makes the place tick.
I guess it's the main cultural thing, isn't it?
It is.
Within the city. You go to other cities and there's lots of other things going on culturally, but in Sunderland, it's always been the football, hasn't it?
It's part and parcel of life. You know, no matter what, look what we're going through now, the crisis we're going through now. One thing for sure, what they will find money for.
Turning up here on a Saturday afternoon. Eh?
Football. Saturday afternoon.
You came the same year as the miners' strike and things like that.
Yeah, the miners' strike. Again, you know, so one thing which, shall we say, no matter what worries you've got, and as a player, you know what I mean? Go out there, 3 o'clock, all your worries have gone.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the same with the supporters. With all the worries and things which are going on in life, come football, 3 o'clock or whatever time it is, they turn up at that stadium, all their worries is abandoned.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just typical of what the area and what this football club is all about. And, you know, we've seen when, you know, we travel away from home, you know, people say, oh, they're going to bring a couple of fans here and there. And like, they're in shock. They cannot believe the amount of supporters who are willing to travel.
A lot of them games in League One last year, like home game away from home, weren't they? Yeah. Some of the smaller stadiums.
Couldn't believe it.
And they were quite far away. You know, Sunderland's probably one of the furthest places you can go. So the fact that we sell out most away allocations around the country and have done for years.
And you know, people say, oh, they're well supported. We're better than well supported. You know, it's an eye-opener.
Yeah.
You know, and I think... Yeah, you know, we were lucky enough to be at Wembley, you know, for the final. And you're just thinking, wow.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
And I think a lot of people who hasn't witnessed that or hasn't seen that, seen it for themselves on that day, even if they weren't in the stadium, and they're thinking, wow, we've got some supporters.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, yeah, I think that's what made the news, wasn't it? The takeover of the Trafalgar Squares the day before, that kind of thing, which they've done many times now.
Many times. And again, you know, we...
And it's not cheap to do that either.
It's not cheap to do it. We talk about it and people say, yeah, they'll take over. And they think, nah, they don't. But then to go and witness it yourself, you're thinking, wow.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Danny?
No, I was going to say, again, when I signed and come up to here, having a little walk around the city centre and whatever day of the week, red and white shirts everywhere, and you think, what's going on here? No, Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday afternoon, and there's red and white shirts everywhere day of the week. It's just live and breathe football, don't they?
And it's interesting, you know, Danny's still living up here in the area.
Well, he got a lot of similarities, you two, actually.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And you know, when Danny signed, if he would have said, oh, I'll be here this length of time, he would also have said, nah, I would have moved on. Who knows where he would have ended up. But slowly but surely, you come part and parcel of the furniture.
Yeah.
You know, it's part and parcel of your club. And, you know, it becomes, you know, unfortunately, you start changing your language and it's us.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah,
you start talking about us all the time, and you know, you start getting really passionate about it. You're passionate about the football club, and as I said, it's something which grows on you,
yeah,
and it becomes part of you. You know, and no matter what.
I guess that's what I was touching upon at the start when I said we need to take a step back and recognise your achievements, because you've been such a constant in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, you were one of the first players to have a poster on my wall was yourself, Paul Bracewell, yeah, players like that, you know, Phil Gray, Craig Russell, that kind of era from 1991 was when I first started coming to the game, yeah, kind of era. And so you've been such a constant, and you know, you continue to be a constant in your media work and your campaigning as well, which, yeah, is why you've been recognised with an MBE. Your campaigning has been pioneering in the UK, but I understand, you know, the reason why you're still campaigning is we still have some way to go.
Yeah.
But have you seen a progression in a positive way over those years?
I've seen progression. We're still learning. We're still developing. You know, and I think we've still got a good understanding now. I think education is key. I think we've all been able to educate ourselves regarding racism or discrimination. I'm a little bit more, shall we say, up to date with things going on. You know, if you would have asked me day one when I walked through that door, you know, about racism, and again, I've said, because I work for Shaw Racing Red Card, have I been racist? I most probably say, yes, I have been racist in some form of way. You know, but we didn't have campaigns like Shaw Racing Red Card, like Kick It Out, which has been able to help to educate ourselves, let us understand a lot more what racism is.
And keep that conversation on the table as well.
That's right, that's right. You know, and, you know, you ask that question, you know, why? Also, you know, I think when you look at, for instance, even the Sunderland team or every team now which is playing either in the Premier League or Football League, I think every team now has maybe a player of colour.
Yeah.
They have somebody, different religions, different nationalities, different cultures. So again, you know, you are sharing a changing room with a lot of different players who's got different, shall we say, aspects in yeah, life. And I think it's only right for you to understand in their, shall we say, religion or nationality or colour.
Backgrounds,
backgrounds.
Yeah.
And again, it's having that conversation. There's nothing wrong with having that conversation and asking, you know, questions. And okay, that's the only way you're going to educate yourself.
I'd like to ask you some questions.
Yes.
Were you racially abused as a player?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, we go back to, obviously, when I started playing, there weren't as many, shall we say, black players playing.
Yeah.
You know, not every team had a black player or a foreign player playing in their team. So it's a rarity. And, you know, we've touched on maybe stereotypes.
Yeah.
So, you know, we would have them stereotypical people who would say, you know, if they came up to me at that time, you know, if there was me and maybe another white player with me, they'll shake the white player's hand or they'll rub my hair and say, oh, that feels just like a microphone. You know, so you look back at things like that and you're thinking, but they most probably weren't educated.
Yeah.
They most probably thinking, you know, again, I'm going back to the 70s when you look at the programs which was on TV. So yeah, you would have the comedians which told
jokes. Casual racism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you had the Black and White Minstrel Show.
Yeah.
Love Thy Neighbour.
Yeah.
You know, Till Death Us Do Part.
Yeah.
All these things was on.
When you're growing up in Manchester.
When you're growing up, it's in your lounge. And, you know, we laughed along with it because you didn't want to, shall we say, upset anybody who went along with it. But now you're a little bit more educated regarding it, and now you challenge.
Yeah.
You know, you can ask them questions.
Did the racist abuse come from the crowd?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, you know, it's funny, you know, especially with the World Cup being on now. So you can go back to when England were playing, and then all of a sudden we had one or two black players representing England, you know, which was another, shall we say, rarity.
Yeah.
Turning point. And I think when you talk to, shall we say, young supporters now, and you talk about monkey chants, you know, a lot of them raise their eyebrows and think, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, what? But that used to happen at every ground, majority grounds. You know, there's the famous one where John Barnes kicking the banana, back-heeling the banana. You know, I played up at Newcastle United. So when we're talking about Shaw Ace and Red Card, I suffered a lot of abuse at Newcastle United. Okay, because you're playing for the rivals. But again, that was something which was acceptable in the stadium. You know, I ended up getting sent off. Howard Gale got sent off on that day as well. So, you know, when we look back at the campaign, that was set up by a Newcastle United supporter. And I called Jed Gredby, who's the chief exec. But that only came around through a goalkeeper who was at Newcastle, I called Shaka Hislop. He was in, there's a petrol station just outside St. James's Park. And he was putting petrol in his car. And he had his back. So he's just putting petrol and he's filling his car up. And there's three or four lads seeing him, just the back of him, putting the petrol in and started shouting racist abuse to him. Oh, you're black this, you're black that, blah, blah, blah. Finished, turned round, and the lads realised it was their goalkeeper, Shaka Hislop. So, oh, Shaka! Shaka! And they come running up. Can I have your autograph? So Shaka said, we'll have to do something about this.
Yeah.
You know, because they've never seen my face.
Yeah.
I'm a black this, black that. But the minute I turn round, I'm their hero. You know, so he set it up. And then obviously they got in touch with me. Got in touch with another player called Curtis Fleming, who was at Middlesbrough at the time as well. And see if we could help, support and be sort of role models and help go into schools and help educate people regarding it.
And that's what you currently do still for them.
Yeah.
Go into places, have these conversations.
That's right.
Make people aware, educate, inform.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And again, you know, from day one, you know, if you would have said that I was doing it to get pats on the back or to do anything, it was just to raise the awareness. That's what we've got involved with it for, to raise the awareness, to educate people, to, you know, hopefully experiences. And again, you know, if somebody uses racist terminology, I always say that I wouldn't class them as a racist. And I think sometimes we've got to be a little bit careful, because if somebody's used to hearing certain words on a daily basis in the household, you know, some they'll grow up thinking that's the right terminology or right words to use. And, you know, we've been to certain areas like maybe some of these mining villages. They've never seen somebody of my complexion.
Yeah.
So, you know, for them to address or what do we say or whatever, sometimes they only pick certain things up off maybe the media, the TV or reading the papers, and they'll think, oh, that's the right word to use.
Yeah.
So again, it's just that experience and getting people to understand what it's all about.
So how would you say where we're at now, Benno, in terms of from your playing days, 80s, 90s, in terms of the racism and the levels? And, you know, is it on the right path? Can a lot more be done? I know you've got social media, as we said before. And I just thinking, looking back to the Euros last year when Rashford, Saka missing the penalties, they get, you know, online.
That's a great point. And that's a point which I brought up a few times in regards of where we are. In my day, we didn't have social media. You know, now you've seen what effect social media has. And I think sometimes you look at social media and I think sometimes they've got to be accountable for things which are allowed to be put on there. But
it's strange what things they can take down and say, like copyright, but they can't take down racist abuse.
So it's a strange one. But, you know, as Danny's just touched on there, you know, you talk about Saka, you talk about Rashford, and you talk about
Sancho. Was it
Sancho was the other one. You know, we're having a fantastic World Cup at the present moment. But, you know, it's always in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
if the result doesn't go well, then what fingers are going to be pointed?
Yeah.
To who and why we've lost the game? You know, at the present moment, Rashford, fantastic. Yeah. He's the man.
Yeah.
You know, Saka's the man. You know, but yeah. That soon changes. You know, yeah. it only takes a minute, and that's what we're saying. You know, we used to have this sort of problem in the stadium. No matter where you are, you know, you look at the both teams, they'll have black players playing for a third team. But all of a sudden, they want to abuse the opponent's players, calling them black this and black that. And you're thinking, whoa, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
You've got black players are playing.
Yeah, you see that.
It's only them. It's just them.
Yeah. Do you think that's where some confusion comes in when at grounds around the UK, sometimes they maybe aren't as respectful to the taking of the knee?
That's a huge question. But, you know, people talk about the taking off the knee. And for me, this is my opinion. It's up to the individual themselves. You know, I wouldn't be telling them that a team to take the knee. That's up to the individual. It's the individual themselves. If they want to do the knee, they do the knee. If they don't want to do it, then fine. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
You know, and again, that shouldn't really cause a big issue. You know, we've seen players when they score goals.
Yeah.
You know, they do certain things. We see players when they're entering pitches. You know, they do certain things. That's up to the individual what they want to do.
Yeah.
You know, that's maybe part and parcel of their religion. That might be part and parcel of something what they believe in. And that's what we've got to understand. We've got to understand the individual. We've got to understand the cause. And we shouldn't really hold that against them.
Yeah. Some high-profile black players don't take the knee as well. I'm not sure where the organisations you work with, where they stand on it. And maybe could you give us a little bit of an understanding for people who don't know about why that was brought in by some of the players?
It was brought in like... What can we say? It's just like having T-shirts.
Which you've done for many.
And where's that got us?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we've had plenty of different, shall we say, things which go on.
Initiatives and campaigns
which go on. And you're thinking, well, has it improved? We're taking a knee, but slowly but surely, you can see it slowly fading out. And that's nothing new to me because at the start, everyone's behind it.
Yeah.
But then slowly, but it loses its way. You know, T-shirts, campaigns, you know, we've had it all trying to tackle it. But there's only so much. And then all of a sudden, it's gone. Then there's something else. There'll be something else happening soon. You know, we talk about taking a knee, whatever it is.
Do you feel that's kind of natural, though, to keep the conversation going?
We've got to keep the conversation going.
Yeah.
It's something which you've got to tackle on a daily basis. It's not going to go away. People say we've improved. We can take, you know, a step forward and two step backwards. That's what's going to happen. You know, we look at the World Cup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, you know, it's fantastic. But, you know, you're just wary that if we get knocked out, they'll be pointing the fingers at somebody.
Yeah. It's always a scapegoat.
Well, you know, Gareth Southgate, he picked the wrong team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rashford never played the other night and they said, oh, he should be playing. He scored two last time. You know, so he's...
You still win 3-0.
And they still win 3-0. So, there's, you know, we have that on a daily basis. We'll have that, you know, we've got the next game coming up against West Brom. You know, it's all about team selection and, you know, the manager... Tony Mowbray, you know, if he picks the right team and they win, fantastic. If he picks the wrong team, it's his fault.
Yeah.
Do you admire, though, that modern high-profile footballers are able to speak about these issues as players in the modern game, maybe a lot easier than when you were playing at first? Do you think that's progress?
Yeah, well, it's huge progress. Well, we've seen what effect it has. And, you know, we go back to Marcus Rashford, you know, what effect he has. And obviously he's been able to hopefully do things or help support. And I think, you know, these high-profile players now are in a position where they can help, you know, fighting discrimination, fighting racism.
Feeding kids.
You know, yeah, they are. You know, but, you know, we've just got to continue doing that. Now, there comes a point when we're talking about campaigns, how far do you get involved in campaigns in regards of obviously politics is quite huge now. Obviously, we've had the issues in regards of Qatar, what's right and what's not right, what you should do and what you shouldn't do and over there and whatever, you know. And I think sometimes for players themselves, I think they they're in a position where really they should be just concentrating on the footballing side rather than getting involved deeply into the political side of it as well, because it only takes saying the wrong word or the wrong message, sending the wrong message out, and that's something which is going to be held against them.
Yeah, tricky times as well, I guess, in that respect then as well for the modern footballer, trying to do the right thing, but obviously find themselves in a situation at a World Cup in the middle of the season in a, you know, in a country which is not rich in football heritage, you know, maybe this decision could have been avoided, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. Then it wouldn't be on the players.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've had a good look, I've had a good listen. And for me, I think, yeah, it's in Qatar. People think that it's right or wrong, but we've just got to go along with it. That's where it is.
It's too late now.
It's too late now. And the other side is that, for me, you've just got to respect the country. Mm-hmm. You know, we cannot all of a sudden go to Qatar and change the rules for 3 weeks.
Yeah,
because that's what we want and that's what we need. You know what I mean? We can't just go there and say, right, everything should be around maybe alcohol or whatever it is. So, you know, what happens when the World Cup finishes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to respect.
I think John Barnes spoke about this
He did quite well. He did very, very well, John Barnes. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, you've got to respect the country.
Yeah. Danny?
No, I was just going to say, yeah, there was all the talk about the armband as well and wearing the armband. Mm-hmm. And I think Gareth Southgate, one of his interviews, his pre-match interviews, he almost was to say, listen, we've tried to do our bit. We're here to focus on trying to win this World Cup. And we need to try and put it to bed as much as we can, though, and, you know, concentrate on the football side of things.
Since finishing playing football, Gary, you've gone on to have a career in the media with our colleagues at BBC Radio Newcastle in particular, and you've been alongside Nick Barnes for a number of years now. How many years have you been commentating?
20.
20 years?
Yeah, 20,
Do you still enjoy it?
I love it. Love it. You know, as I said, Danny's in that side of it as well. I think you've got to have a love for football and the football club itself. You know, and if you know, from day one, you know, I was asked to come along with Nick. He wanted somebody to, shall we say, co-host with him. And I said, nah, it's not for me.
Had you had any kind of tasters or anything beforehand?
No, none at all. None at all. He said, come along and see how it goes. And you know, I love it, you know, and, you know, you just see now how much it's grown. You know, if you said 20 years ago, it was, you know, Danny will back me up in this. And sometimes, you know, you used to go to games and sometimes if you were injured or you were in the squad, you might be called upon to help, you know, help the local radio person out to sit alongside them. But now it's a huge, huge platform.
Yeah. And you've been the voice of Sunderland Football Club for so long through that as well. But, you know, years before that as well, that's what I mean about being such a constant here in Sunderland. Like, you know, to me, you are part of the tapestry of the city.
Yeah, and, you know, people, you know, I speak to the club and I speak to players and, you know, again, you know, me and Danny have been lucky, you know, and I just think when you get to the point when you've got to retire or call it a day, you want to, you know, you're thinking, well, what am I going to do? You know, you're thinking, oh, there's only so many times like you're doing the school runs.
Especially when you've been used to such strict routine as well.
And then you're used to doing something on a daily basis and then you're thinking, well, what am I going to do? And if you haven't got anything in place, unfortunately, you'll get lost.
Yeah, which I'm sure former colleagues will have gone off the wagon, you know.
That's right. So you soon get lost in the system. And then you're thinking, you're scratching your head and you're scratching around, what am I going to do or whatever. And, you know, what I'm trying to do now is trying to get former players or players who are playing now involved in any form of charities which they can help, you know, which may be able to for them to fall back on when they finish playing, you know, give them something to, shall we say, occupy themselves when they finish playing, you know, even if they're doing a day here or a day there or whatever. You know, that's something which is, I find, very beneficial to myself.
Yeah.
You know, and very rewarding for myself as well. You know, if you can, I know a lot you hear that old statements, people saying, I haven't got time.
Mm.
Well, I'm surprised. You know, surely you've got an hour or couple of hours spare somewhere. I'm not saying to go and do it 24/7, but I'm saying if you can occupy yourself or even give an hour or 2 hours a week or somewhere or help somebody or any form of charity or whatever, I tell you what, it's very, very rewarding in the end.
I'm just bringing you both in on this because, Danny, okay, so in the last couple of years, you've gone through this and you're doing your licences with the Welsh FA right now and you've ended up back at Sunderland doing some coaching. Obviously, you work with me. I'm sorry about that on a regular basis. But is there any kind of infrastructure for players leaving football for apart from colleagues like yourself just saying you should come and help out with this? Surely there should be some kind of structure for players that, you know, they can't just hang the boots up and then, you know, go and play golf for the rest of their lives.
I think the PFA, you can get in touch, can't you? They obviously have different courses that they can try and push you towards. I think they give a contribution towards it as well.
Okay.
But yeah, I think as Benno says there, it's up to yourself as well. You've got to, once you finish playing, it's like, if you haven't got anything in place, it's right, okay, what am I doing now? You know, school runs and then you're sat around at home. Mm-hmm. You know, there's only so much of loose women you can watch on during the afternoon. You've got to get up to something. And no, as you say, I'm, from my point of view, doing my stuff with yourself, the co-coms and working on the A licence. You know, I retired in 2019, so it's a couple of years off the grass and you do miss it. Getting back out there in the last year or two, obviously with the 18s, a couple of days a week at the minute, enjoy it, just being out there and they're doing really well. So from my point of view, and there's other lads, you know, Lee Cattermole bumped into Lee last week, Middlesbrough, Grant's obviously over there. And the lads who I've played with have gone into coaching and management, and it's something I feel I should perhaps give a go. And I know you obviously have done the same. And
you miss that buzz. You miss the changing rooms. You know, getting up every day, going in 9 o'clock, and you know, from that 9 till maybe 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, amongst the lads having a laugh, doing this, that, and the other. Once that's taken away from you, you know, you're thinking, well, where am I going to get the buzz from?
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. You know, it's like a fix. You know, where are we going to get it from? Oh. And then it's sort of adapting to that. It's adapting to that. And, you know, the family's got to adapt to it because all of a sudden you're at home 24/7 with the wife or the children and you're thinking you don't actually know what it's like when you've got a little urn and they're screaming 24/7 or they're sick and whatever. And this is what your wife's got to go through and taking them to school, picking them up, dropping them off here, dropping them off there. And,
you're thinking,
and you're usually away from it because I'm away for 2-3 days. Yeah. I'm, you know, drunk myself. Oh, we've got a game. Oh, don't worry. Don't bother me, love. Instead, I've got to concentrate. I've got a game tomorrow.
I'm an athlete. Yeah.
And now, he's screaming down the phone.
Yeah. I don't know if you've heard any of these podcasts before, Gary, but it's tradition that Danny does a little bit of a quiz with the guest on the show. And there's going to be a mix of questions, I understand.
Yeah, mix. 5 questions, Ben.
Five?
See where you're at. Couple of,
I'm not good at quizzes.
The champion, by the way, is Lyndon Gucci. He got 5 out of 5.
Yeah. Right.
5 out of 5 for Lyndon.
Christian Speakman once got 0 out of 5.
Okay.
So it doesn't take much to beat him.
Zero of
her. Yeah. Off the mark and you're doing okay. Okay, mate. So first one's all about yourself, Benno, and you touched on this earlier on. So on your debut for Sunderland, you scored. Who was it against and who was the goalkeeper?
Peter Shilton and Southampton. Yes. That one always comes up because I just sort of spice it up. He said, you know, I keep saying, oh, you couldn't believe it. He said, supposedly the best keeper in the world at the time. And a beating from 25 yards.
Oh, was it? So it was only
a tapping.
It was headed like Maradona getting above him, no? Yeah, what was the score? Can you remember the score?
3-1.
3-1. Oh,
good start.
Running, running, yeah.
Good start. 1 out of 5.
A couple of general knowledge ones that you've got now, Benno, as well. England World Cup. Who scored England's first goal of the World Cup?
This World Cup.
Yeah.
Iran game, remember it now? Seems like
6-2.
6-2.
Did I watch the game? I think I did.
I did.
I think it was Jude Bellingham.
It was Jude Bellingham. Header, wasn't it?
Have you been impressed with him at the World
Cup?
He's
a good player.
He's so good.
He's only 19.
Wow.
He's got some career in front of him.
Certainly has. Right, third question.
Christmas themed, as we're into the month of December. Which of Santa's reindeer comes first alphabetically?
Alfonso. No.
Is there one called Alfonso?
I don't know.
Blitzen.
Blitzen.
Blitzen. Ah! Yeah. I'm going to for a full house there.
Hey.
Blitzing.
Yeah. Enough for next time.
No.
US states. Been to the states a few times.
Go on.
Yeah, okay. So, which of the US states is the only one that doesn't have a straight line on one of its borders?
Oh, that's a hard one.
That
Danny.
Is a hard one. I tell you what, you've come out with them
is
today.
It, so, something quite rugged then, a rugged state.
Rugged state.
To make it not able to cut the line, yeah. I guess.
The only one the without state. A straight line border.
State.
How many is it? 52?
You've
got 52
so
to choose.
Get rid of
51.
I'll say Louisiana.
Hawaii.
Oh, it's a trick one because it's an island.
Yeah.
That was a trick. Yeah. Trick question, well, Danny. Still on two.
Easy when you know the answer.
Yeah, exactly.
And the last one, Benno. What is the title of the hit song that your daughter co-wrote in 2015 for Jess Glynn, which was her first UK solo number one? Oh. For 3 weeks, it was at number one. You want a little clue on hand. This one?
Hold hand. Hold. Is it hold my hand?
Hold my hand is correct.
Yes. Yes. You've done well there.
Yeah.
Well done. 3 out of 5.
Good. 3 out of 5, good effort, yeah.
Bloody yeah. I think it has been recently spoke of because your daughter, Gingin, as she's known in the music industry, she recently had a big TV screen in Times Square, of all places. I mean, that's pretty impressive. I mean, she's had a pretty impressive career to date, but, you know, that's pretty cool.
Funny enough, it's just she just texted us the other day to wish me happy birthday. I said, oh, Dad, happy birthday. He said, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to board a flight. I said, flight? I'm going to Jamaica. For 3 days. I just had a call. Jamaica for 3 days to do some work with Sean Paul.
Really?
Yeah, I said, all right. So, yeah. And then last week, obviously I went for my award, but she lives in Windsor, my daughter's. So on her way out, I'm just about to get the train. She said, oh, I'm at somebody's house. Would he come round to say bye-bye? So I goes round. It was in Maida Vale. So goes round. She opens the door, goes in, and she's there with her friend Jess Glynn.
Oh, look at that.
I said, oh, lovely. Said, that's how the other life
doing okay
life
for
live.
Herself, Benno.
Huh?
Doing okay for herself, yeah.
Remember your dad?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, her dad, very much royalty around the northeast of England. Gary, thanks so much for the sitting down with you.
Been a pleasure.
On SFC Cheers, Unfiltered. Yeah. I'm sure that the fans will appreciate it as much as we have here in the room. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.